You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Screens of the Stone Age, the podcast where scientists review movies about prehistoric people. I'm Dr. Joshua Lindell. I'm a paleoanthropologist studying Neanderthals, and I'm here with...
I'm Dr. Kimberly Plump today. I'm Dr. Ross Barnett, paleogeneticist interested in the phylogeny of Ice Age felids.
And I'm Dr. Carlton Schildchief-Gover, curator of archaeology at the University of Kansas and professor of anthropology at the University of Kansas.
Thanks for joining us today, Carlton. You are filling in for Kim, apparently, who called in sick early this morning, or late in the evening for her, I guess. We've invited you here because we're reviewing the movie Prey from 2022. This is a kind of heavily requested movie for us, by which I mean we've got at least two requests for this movie. And I've been wanting to do this movie for a long time, but it's like not really in our wheelhouse, right? Like it's set in 1719, so this is pretty much historical fiction, way far away from the Stone Age, but for whatever reason, people who listen to our show want to hear us talk about this movie. And I've been wanting to do it for a while, but I wanted to make sure we have a Plains archaeologist, and that is what you are. So hopefully we can have an archaeological discussion about this movie that doesn't actually feature any archaeology, doesn't actually feature any cavemen, which is what we normally do. But I think we'll have a lot to talk about. So to start off, Carlton, can I ask you to summarize the movie for any listeners who haven't seen it?
Absolutely. So the movie Prey from 2022 is a prequel to the Predator franchise, right? And so it is about the protagonist is played by Amber Midthunder, who plays a young Comanche woman by the name of Naru, as it's this coming of age story. It features the Comanches in the Northern Great Plains in 1719. And it's this group of Comanches around the same age, Naru being one of the leads, breaking some of the norms of gender roles within her community, not trying to go directly to the hunting-gathering route, but also trying to prove themselves as an accomplished hunter. Through this, they come into contact with two different kinds of aliens, Europeans and then extraterrestrial. And through that, they navigate contact with both the Europeans, which are shown through the lens of French traders up the Missouri River Valley, but then also a predator. I think they call it the feral predator is how they describe the take on the predators in this one, as it's being dropped off into the Northern Plains, where it's going through its own blooding process of also trying to come of age, its own coming of age story of hunting all the beasts of the Northern Plains, from rattlesnakes, wolves, bears to humans. Then ultimately our protagonist, Naru, is able to defeat the predator, and then through this becomes, I believe, a war chief of her Comanche band or Comanche village, and it kind of sunsets off from there. But there's a lot that goes on, I think, like an hour and 40 minutes into that movie. But basics.
All right, so can we start off with historical inaccuracies in this movie? I think, first of all, we can say that this is a pretty accurate in a lot of ways in general, especially compared to a lot of the movies that we watch.
So, I mean, for like context, right, for your listeners, like I'm a citizen of the Pawnee Nation from Nebraska and Kansas, but I have cousins that are both Comanche and Shoshone, and so I've spent a lot of time in Wind River, a lot of time in Lawton, Oklahoma. I've been pretty familiar with both groups. In terms of accuracies of the movie, 1719 is pretty late for the Comanches to still be in the Northern Plains. By this time, they're pretty well settled where we think of Comanches today, being in Texas, Colorado, and like the Southern Great Plains. Already have had horses by this time. Additionally, as a large group of French traders that far up the Missouri River would also be probably like three or four decades too early. But other than just some timing of where these folks would be, it's not too bad. I believe one of the producers. Yeah, Jane Myers. She herself is Comanche and has done a lot of work in Native film spaces. Yeah, she's Comanche and Blackfeet, especially when it comes to Native cultural advising. So, I mean, like, they had Comanche cultural advisors present on the regalia, on the language, because they do speak the language a bit throughout, outside of the dubbed version in Comanche. So they took great care to represent the Comanche folks well in this, I believe.
Great.
Could they have fixed a lot of that by just setting it in the southern Great Plains rather than the northern Great Plains?
In terms of, like, the historical stuff, yeah.
And yeah, in terms of the historical continuity, if they just said southern Great Plains, is that not an error anymore?
I believe so, and then maybe switch the French to, like, the Spanish or something like that. But, you know, this was filmed on a reservation in, or a reserve in Canada, right? So this was filmed mm-hmm. on tribal territory. So, I mean, like, there was still continuity between the Comanches and, like, the Comanches and the Shoshones are practically the same people. And so, like, there is continuity and exchange between, like, Wyoming and Montana with Texas. So there's still that relationship there. But yeah, just setting the Comanches up in the northern Great Plains, which presumably is, like, Montana, southern Canada, mm-hmm. it was just take some liberties.
The landscape, the scenery in this movie is really beautiful, and it really mm-hmm. works well for the movie. So I can understand why they chose the filming location that they did.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we always talk about, especially Ross, is the sort of geographical confusion, the confusion in the biology. And I think that this movie is pretty good about that. We've got a lot of animals. We got a lot of focus on plants this time too, which usually movies kind of overlook plants and they sort of don't really think about the natural biogeography of plants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wonder, Ross, what do you think about the animals? I have a list of a lot of the animals that we see. Pretty much most of them make sense, except I might have a couple of notes about some of them.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. It didn't take me out of the film at all, which was nice. They have, you know, some of the classic big carnivores that would have been native to the region. So you have encounters with puma, cougar, mountain lion, whatever you want to call it. Puma concolor, the large big small cat in the Americas, and that's done quite nicely. I think it was mostly CGI for the puma. It looked CGI. It also didn't make the right kind of sounds. So, like, puma are not part of the panthera cats, the big roaring cats, so they can't roar, but they can snarl and scream and make a whole bunch of god-awful noises. You know, the classic kind of shriek of a puma is very familiar to people who've watched any kind of TV, and it appears in a lot of music as well. I'm thinking of what is the song that I'm thinking of now? I can't remember, but it has been sampled. There are tunes where you can hear sampled puma screams as well, and they will be recognizable if you hear them. So that it gets kind of minus points for that. But puma are found in the region still today, so that makes sense. There's also a very, very big brown bear, also CGI, which attacks Naru at one point. And this is one of the coolest things in the movie, obviously apart from the giant extraterrestrial hunter, was the fact that that showed that Naru knew the habits and the nature of the animals that she lived with. So when she was escaping from the bear, she dove under the water and into the submerged entrance to a beaver lodge, which I thought was really cool, because that's how you get into a beaver lodge. That's part of the reason why beavers build lodges, is so they have this kind of escape route, which can only be accessed underwater, which kind of cuts off the chances of things like wolves, pumas, and bears from getting at them, because these are fairly predatable giant rodents, which don't have many natural kind of defense characteristics apart from their engineering. So I thought it was a really neat thing to do, to show her escaping from the bear by diving into the water and up into the lodge, and having the kind of wood of the lodge protect her from the bear attack. And I also thought it was cool that, unlike many of the films we've watched, these animals, the predators, behaved in realistic ways. They didn't go all out for, you know, half an hour at a time trying to get one individual. They kind of attacked and then gave up and went off and did something else, which I thought was fairly realistic as well.
They also sort of commented on that because for a large part of the beginning of the movie, they're tracking down this cougar because he's taken one of the group members. And when they find him, Naru, I think it is, says something's wrong. Why would the cougar leave him here instead of eating him? Something bigger must have scared it away, right?
And it was one thing I sort of looked up based on watching this film is just how vanishingly rare puma attacks are in the Americas. There's something like there's been 23 fatalities over the overall of kind of recorded history. So over the past 150 years, fewer than 100 actual attacks, and most of the fatalities are either young children or women that have been killed by pumas. And in context, you know, this more people die from lightning strikes, more people die from anaphylactic shock, from bee stings. You know, guaranteed more people have been killed by cows and dogs than have been killed by pumas over the past 100+ years. So these are very, I don't want to say not dangerous, but certainly not not something to be terrified of. They're fairly fairly kind of shy of humans and don't really interact with us in many ways.
Did you see that video probably like 10 years back at this point, but there was a video of a hiker who sort of stumbled too close to some cubs, and this mother cougar was sort of chasing him, and he was basically walking backwards down the path, and she was just sort of stalking him and screaming at him, and it's like 5 minutes and he's like filming the whole way.
Yeah,
I guess so that everyone would know how he died when they found his body or something.
Yeah, that video is terrifying. But, you know, it had a happy ending. The guy got away. He did everything right. So, you know, puma, because they're not very big. I mean, they're kind of big Labrador-sized animals. They don't want, they're not going to go for a full-grown adult unless you sort of trigger some kind of response by getting between them and their cubs or by crouching down and appearing to be a small target. So he did absolutely the best thing, which is keep eye contact the whole time, stay big, stay large, and just keep walk calmly backwards while talking at it to sort of reduce the chances of it springing out.
There was a fantastic photo from at the beginning of COVID when it was all puzzles and hot cocoa and we'll be done with this in 30 days if everyone just does what they're supposed to of in Boulder, Colorado after a blizzard, but everyone's still inside. There's this photo of a family of cats walking down the street in downtown Boulder because like it's just silent. You know, no one's moving around, and I'm a huge hunter and a hunting enthusiast, and there are more cougars today than there were 200, 300 years ago, because they're just not being competed with bears and other, or wolves, and them being these ghost cats has allowed their populations to explode. And I think they're in almost every Midwestern state now, although those wildlife offices refuse to acknowledge their presence because it kind of spooks people, even though game cameras from Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma are capturing them in numbers. It's like, no, they're not here. But what I would like to say about that scene where they come across their friend originally, right? This also, in terms of the movie context, doesn't reduce the Comanches to helplessness, right? Like, they get there, Naru's immediately like, oh, let's go, we know how to do this, let's go gather the local herbs, showing knowledge of local medicinal plants and vegetation. It's not just her, right? Everybody else is running around grabbing things. And so they can immediately stabilize their buddy and then just like move on, showing that these aren't just like wild primitive people, but they are very much, as anyone would in a landscape, familiar with the resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That was totally great. How much agency all the characters had. Like, there's no, unlike, you know, even with the original Predator film, where we kind of get to know the characters, but some of them are clearly just cannon fodder for the big bad Predator. Everyone felt quite rounded and had their own internal lives in this film, which was nice.
Absolutely.
We could talk about the plants a little bit because that's, the plants feature pretty prominently in this movie in a way that, like, not really in any other movie we've really watched, right? There's two main plants that we see. The first one is breadroot. I think they just call it breadroot. And that's a real plant that I think would really be found on most of the Great Plains, right?
Let me check. I'm not a botanist. Kelly Kincher out of Kansas does a lot of ethnobotany with Missouri River tribes. I believe he just came out with a new book. It's like Medicinal Plants and Herbs of Missouri River Indians. That would be a good one. I'm trying to look it up. Because like some of these tubers, you know, they have so many different colloquial names. And so like I've heard, I think in Wyoming, we called it biscuit root. And yeah, same thing, that type of bread root, the kind of tuber, tastes like a carrot. It's fine.
And yeah, she's digging this at the beginning. This is the gathering part of the hunting and gathering. She's got this hatchet or tomahawk that her it's her mother told her that she's supposed to be using that hatchet for digging up bread root and not for hunting white-tailed deer as she tried to do afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know, bread root, it's a real thing. It's a real sort of tuberous root that was a food for lots of people. I guess maybe still is. I don't think this grows where I am. I'm on kind of just before the edge of the Great Plains, so I don't think I've ever seen this growing here.
I was part of a caloric return study during my master's where we went out and like dug biscuit root in the Red Desert in Wyoming. We're like basically timing ourselves in patches how much we could collect in a certain period of time. But like I think by the time we were out there in late May, it was a little bit more difficult to find. But this would have been heavily reliant. Our Shoshones and Comanches in the Northwest Plains would have been heavily reliant on this for subsistence. No doubt about that.
Was it ever kind of not just wild gathered, but did people ever plant it deliberately? Was it kind of put on the process of domestication, or was it something that was just accessible through the area where people lived?
I don't believe it was ever like formally domesticated, like with the tribes out in the east and southwest, like maize, beans, corn, squash, and sunflower was. You do find this kind of biscuit root or bread root around plains towns, but that just might be a byproduct of trash, you know, throwing them out and then them growing in those areas. But like, you know, agriculture in the Northwest Plains, like Wyoming, Montana, wasn't really practiced by those groups. And then especially as like, you know, the Comanche being an excellent example, once they get horses, they just do full-time like bison nomadism.
Cool.
The other plant, which ties into the plot a lot more, is they call it orange totsia. And it seems like this is a fictional plant. Everywhere I've read online, basically everyone thinks that this is based on calendula. And I think from what I read online, totsia maybe is just the Comanche word for flower. So they're basically just saying orange flower. But this plant has some serious medicinal properties because they use it several times to sort of reduce bleeding in people who are injured. But it has the side effect, because it lowers blood pressure, of making people feel very cold and then actually reducing your body temperature enough that the predator can't see you. And calendula is used to lower blood pressure and to sort of slow bleeding. Traditionally, and in fact, I've got some. Ooh. I got my own little jar of orange totsia here, and having taken this before, it does not make me feel cold. I do not think that it reduces my body temperature appreciably. But like, this is one of the problems with this movie, is that to reduce your body temperature beyond a couple of degrees, that's called hypothermia and you die. So the idea that this flower can reduce your body temperature enough that the predator can't see you, it's like, what's the threshold on the predator's heat vision? Like 36 degrees Celsius, and then sort of everything below that is sort of washed out, or
right?
So that's like sort of a plot hole in the movie, because they really, she uses this flower so that he can't see her, but it's not really realistic that she could lower her body temperature enough that it's going to be below his threshold of heat vision, right?
And for her to actually be able to function, to kind of make all these elaborate traps while she has a core temperature of sub 36 degrees, I mean, when you're that cold, your brain is not working.
Where she's violently shivering and trying to use her bow and arrow or her hatchet or whatever.
Because it's like pretty instant too. Like it's almost like the second that flower hits their lips, they immediately start going like, I'm cold. And so like really, I mean, they're just trying to set up the plot device, right? And the first predator's already, you know, used the mud trick. And so they're sitting there like, well, we can't use the freezer like in Predator 2. What do we do to lower this body heat or else, you know, to try to give some sort of advantage? Because that's, you know, as part of this whole film franchise, the predator, you know, thermal vision is like kind of a quintessential aspect to that series. So there's always, you got to find a way to beat the predator vision.
I mean, it doesn't make sense realistically, but it does serve the movie well because, again, you've got the way to beat the predator, which we already know how the predator sees. So we know that's what they have to do. We have the knowledge of plant medicine, which is a nice thing to feature. We also, this sort of also ties into the movie has this whole thing about gender roles, right? Because she's a woman, she wants to do her, you know, hunting rite of passage, and all the men don't think that she's capable of doing it. Her mother says that she should be harvesting breadfruit rather than hunting whitetails. But it's the, you know, using, she has both knowledges, right? She beats the predator by using the what the movie is telling us is the traditional women's knowledge of medicine. And so it ties into that whole thing. Maybe we can talk about that a bit because, you know, the movie is setting up this traditional men as hunters, women as gatherers sort of thing. And I don't know if we know, is this a realistic thing for the Comanche, or is this something that we assume from our modern perspective that non-Western peoples would have subscribed to this hunter-gatherer gender roles?
Yeah, that one's a little bit out my wheelhouse. I can say generally, like the Plains horse nomads, there were more defined gender roles in terms of like of and not to promote one as being higher on a higher pedestal than the other, right? Just like, this is your role in our society. It must be done in order for the benefit of the group. Generally in those horse nomad societies, like, yeah, men were more predisposed to hunting and warfare as primary responsibilities, and women were more relegated to child rearing, maintaining the home. Like they, I believe, at least with the Lakota, not saying it's immediately crossed over to the Comanche, women owned the lodge. Like they owned the teepee. They owned the house, right? So that was their responsibility. They were owners of it. They weren't caretakers of it. They owned it. And so I believe it's similar here. But I do want to say, right, like in this movie, our main character is not diminishing the advice of her mom, right? Like she's taking advice from both her brother and her mom. She's not saying, well, I just want to be a hunter, I don't want to do the medicine thing. She's doing both roles, and throughout the entire movie she's shown to be taking in everything she can from her mentors, right? And so you know, it's not a clear cut like, oh, well, I just don't want to do the women thing. It's like, no, she's doing that in her society as well as wanting to do more and take on responsibilities that are mostly relegated to her brother.
It's also, you know, she wants to do this, what seems to be a traditionally male rite of passage, and the men around her don't think that she can do it, but there's never a question that she's allowed to. Like, sure, if you want to do it, you can do it. It's just, I don't think that you're going to be able to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her brother seems to be kind of in her corner, though. Her brother seems to be on her side, which is nice.
Going back to the animals, there's a few we can talk about here. She's got a dog with her, and that dog is the actual dog they used is not a trained actor dog, and that's because they wanted to choose a specific breed of dog, which is called the Carolina dog, which I think is also called the American Dingo. And so this is kind of a sort of wild breed of American dog that they sort of... like, I didn't read that much about it, but they, I think it's sort of like a feral American dog that traces back to the original dogs brought over from the original peopling of the Americas. And then they sort of have bred it into a breed of course, because it's a feral dog, it's going to be admixing with all of the dogs brought later. So they've tried to sort of breed it back to this original American dog. And I think that there's only a small number of associations that recognize it as a true breed. But anyway, they chose this dog despite not being a trained actor dog, specifically because they thought it would be a sort of a realistic dog to what the people would have at this time, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of effort to go to. And it was a phenomenal actor. I mean, it shows that, you know, amateurs can do the job.
Yeah. I mean, they did train the dog. They got this dog before the movie started and trained it, right? So it just wasn't an actor previously, as most dogs in most movies would be. Another thing about the animals, there's a couple of scenes with rats, and I don't know how to tell species of rats well enough. Ross, I don't know if you picked up on that.
No, I did not. But yeah, I cannot tell the difference between a Norwegian rat, a brown rat, or anything like that. They're just ratty to me. I mean, this is where Kim might be able to help, because she had pet rats for a time.
That's true.
I might be able to give us the information that we need.
Well, first of all, I'm pretty sure that the Norwegian rat is the brown rat.
Okay, well, that shows. I don't know what I'm talking about, definitely.
The brown rat is Rattus norvegicus. There's also the black rat, which is also known as...
Is that Rattus rattus?
Rattus rattus. These are the two most common worldwide rats. Both of them are not native to the Americas. They both come from the colonization. There are a couple of kinds of rats in the Americas, but they're quite different looking. And so as far as I can tell, obviously most of these rats are going to be... computer generated. The rats that are chewing on the guy's leg stump after he got his leg cut off, I'm sure those were entirely computer generated. But there's also a scene where the dog brings a rat in his mouth after Naru has just gotten out of the quicksand or the muskeg, and she's sort of cleaned herself off, and then the dog shows up with a rat in its mouth. And as far as I can tell, it looks like a brown rat, and the brown rats are kind of big, and they have these sort of small ears compared to the other rats. So they look to me like a brown rat, but again, these rats are not indigenous to the Americas, and so I don't know how long it took rats to colonize the Americas, but I do know that it took a while, because I don't know if you know this fact, but Alberta, where this was actually filmed, famously doesn't have rats.
Oh, right.
They had a serious campaign throughout the early 20th century, and it worked because rats hadn't reached Alberta yet. And so that's why I don't think that there would be rats on the Great Plains in 1719, because I know that Alberta had this campaign because they could see the rats moving across the Canadian prairies, and they're like, the rats are going to get here and they're going to decimate our agriculture. And so they had this serious campaign to stop rats from getting into the province. And today they still claim that Alberta is totally rat-free. It's the only province or territory or state in North America that is completely rat-free.
Wow.
And they really take it seriously. If they have like a number for if you find a rat, report it, basically.
Right.
So, yeah, the rats had a couple of scenes in this movie, and I again, it depends, because I'm not an expert in rats. I don't know for sure that we're looking at a brown rat there, but it seems to me like it's probably a brown rat. Yeah. And so I don't think that we should expect to be finding brown rats on the prairies in 1719.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, I mean, if those French kind of settlers are there, they probably would have had stores that would have been infested with rats as well. So maybe it's a clue that the dog has been sniffing around where the French are.
And the French guy's got his stumps chewed up because the rats were just directly with him when he brought them.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just looking through some of the New World murids, and they are mostly incredibly cute. They don't look evil, like brown rats or black rats. So yeah, there you go.
We can talk a little bit about stone tools. We're an archaeology show here, right? We've got archery, we've got this tomahawk. There's one really obvious inaccuracy where she is sitting in the teepee and she is sharpening her tomahawk with another stone knife. And these are both, I think the knife is definitely a chipped stone knife. Mm-hmm. I think that the tomahawk is also chipped stone from what I could see. You can make an axe head from ground stone as well, but it does look like hers is chipped stone. And so she is sharpening this tomahawk with her stone knife as you would a steel knife with a grinding stone. So she's dragging it across the surface. And this is not the way that you would sharpen a chipped stone implement. You would chip it. And so as the edge gets dulled, you would take new flakes off the edge to reveal sharp edges again. So that is a kind of a funny scene for as an archaeologist watching that.
Yeah, that was immediate for me watching them. And also, why would you use, because it looked like chert, the type of stone tool that was being used, and you wouldn't use a blade like that for as a digging implement, right? You use a digging mm-hmm. stick, you use something that's easily way more renewable and easy to make, because like, if you were to snap that piece of stone, which should have happened multiple times throughout this movie, you'd have to like put that thing back together all over again after making a new blade. So I mean, there was some liberties with it, like it was cool to see it, but practically there's no way you'd be using an implement like that in that manner. And I think they showed later one of the young men before he gets like annihilated in that first group like predator scene. He had an adze of some sort. He had a ground stone head. I believe it was an axe head, ground stone, that he was using. That would have made a hell of a lot more sense. Although that would take a couple hundred hours of grinding to get down to that. Mm-hmm. But that would have been much more accurate than.
And is, I mean, I don't know, but is chert, is it a common thing to find in the area that this film is set, or is it something that would be quite rare at the time and quite valuable?
So chert is the same thing as flint. Flint comes in beds, chert comes in cobbles. The Northern Plains does have good chert localities. Not quite sure where they are in Canada, but I mean, honestly, like obsidian's pretty big in Wyoming. You find like a decent amount of obsidian stone, chipstone tools out there, but it didn't, it looked like Knife River flint to me, or a gray flint in general. So like it would have been fine. It was one of the only pieces of flint material that we see. I guess the arrowheads were made out of flint, but I mean, those things were so hafted onto the arrow shafts. Like it was hard to tell what the material was, but I imagine those two are probably little flint arrowheads.
Knife River flint is also something that we commonly see in Manitoba. I think it's like we don't have good high quality sources in Manitoba, so Knife River flint is like the good high quality stuff that we find. Where does that come from? The Dakotas? Where does that come from?
Yeah, North Dakota. So it's right there on the border. Yeah. And it's high quality, it's a very dark brown. And so, I mean, I have to get a close up on that axe, but I thought the axe was a little bit more gray. And my guess is that they probably got someone to make that stone tool out of Edwards Plateau chert, which is like really common in Texas. That's relatively cheap on the Rockhounds websites. That a lot of flint knappers are going to have access to. Like it's a pretty good material. So that's what I would imagine that material is actually made of for the movie. But I'm not a lithicist. I study corn and pottery, and so I could absolutely be wrong there.
Well, we study bones and DNA, so that's enough. One thing that surprised me is I am sort of a casual fan of archery. We have a lot of bows and arrows in here. I always look at this in movies because there's a lot of different ways to draw a bowstring. Mm-hmm. And you can always tell a pretty bad movie where they sort of pinch the arrow itself and draw back, where typically you want to hold the string and draw back so that the arrow releases smoothly. And the way I was taught to do this is with three fingers. You hold the string with three fingers and the arrow goes between your index finger and your middle finger. And they're doing this, but their hand is upside down. And I've never seen this archery posture before. It looked so strange to me. And I don't know if there's any way to know how people drew their bowstring 300 years ago, but because everyone's doing it this way, and it feels so distinct to me because I've never seen this grip before. I don't know if you know anything about that, but you did say that you were a hunter, so maybe you know a bit about archery at all.
I wish I was that good to do like recurve stuff. Like I have one. I've never been successful like archery hunting, especially out like in Colorado and Wyoming, where you know you're not on a tree stand. You're out there like stalking in the mountains. This sort of like ethnographic record is a little bit beyond my expertise. Although folks like Dr. Devin Pettigrew or Dr. Justin Garnett out of Sol Ra State University, who their careers are dedicated towards projectile, ancient weapons, ballistics, and projectiles, and recreating various atlatls, darts, bows, and arrows. Like I believe Devin, Dr. Pettigrew, like has either a Cheyenne or created either a Cheyenne or Comanche short bow by looking at different museum pieces. They have a website. I believe it's like basketmakeratlatl.com, something goofy like that. They would know, but those you'd have to dive into those Brieux of ethnography records from the Smithsonian back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. I imagine they have a whole book dedicated to bows and arrows of Plains Indians or of the Comanche, but I just don't know of because that caught me off guard too, to see how their hands were shifted like that, just almost, you know, completely 180 from where they were holding it. And that just, even trying to do that myself, I don't know what muscle groups being engaged with, but it's not comfortable. Whatever that is, like that's like a like more, I guess, lats. I don't know. Like it just does not feel natural to hold a bow in the string like that. And I could imagine having any form of probably 30 pounds of pressure on that bowstring. Yeah.
I feel if you're holding the bow horizontal, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah,
like but horizontally. But then when you lift it up, it's backwards.
Right.
So
there's like a range, and I guess like if you're right, it is flat right because those, you know, Amerindian bows were not straight vertical. They were tilted a little bit. So I guess depending, and if you're on horseback, I could see it. Which the Comanches at this time would have had horses. Like they acknowledge it. You kind of hear them in camp when they come across the French horses, the brothers immediately, like, I need to get myself a horse. And we know, now that like Amerindians had horses prior to, the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, not before 1492, making that clear, but they had access to horses before the Pueblo Revolt. So yeah.
I remember hearing or reading something probably early in my anthropology studies about how the horse was so important for these Southern Plains peoples that within like 100 years of acquiring the horse, it had become part of the origin story. Like their oral tradition basically within 100 years is like horses have been with us since the beginning of time, essentially. I don't know if there's truth to that.
So, I mean, this is my caveat. So my nation, Pawnee Nation, and the other Missouri Plains Indians, which have been in the plains for a very long time, who were in the plains before we had horses. And our oral stories, you know, corn is first, and then we get horses later. Sometimes we get the Spanish before horses, or most of the time we get horses before Spanish. And even corn has not been in the Americas since 15,000 years. The horse nomads, which show up later, like the Comanche, Lakota, Cheyenne, which show up in the Great Plains in like the 16, 1700s with horses, when their oral traditions say we've always had horses since we've been in the Great Plains, they're not wrong. But that argument of like, we've always been here, we've always had horses, it's like, well, wait a minute. Like, you guys haven't always been here. We're not saying there's anything wrong with that. But some of the things that come out about, you know, horses have always been here. That's a cover up by archaeologists. It's coming from like a very select few tribes and select individuals within those tribes that are saying those things. But more broadly, like plains, indigenous nations that were more focused on agriculture are very much realistic of like, yeah, Europeans brought horses. We're well aware of that. We did get them before we met the Spanish sometimes. you know, they were brought onto the Continental Indigenous Trade Network early on. Like, the Apaches saw, like, what are these? Started raiding Spanish towns and taking the horses and immediately bringing them onto the market. And so, like, those things spread so quick. Like, I think one of our earliest radiocarbon dates for that paper that we did, the early dispersal of horses in the Rockies and American Plains from 2022, where we showed this, was in Idaho. Like, in 1640, we find horse remains that we dated to like central Idaho. And so, like, we showed chronologically just how quickly horses got out of the Southwest. And it's part of the Comanches getting out of Wyoming and from the Shoshone, is like they hit kind of a carrying capacity in Wyoming with how big their numbers were getting. And they're, I believe, now I'm diving into lore from my cousin told me like 6 years ago, where I may have been sleep deprived in Wind River Indian Reservation, but they had like a game or contest to decide who needed to like leave Wyoming. And so the Comanches were the ones, according to this Eastern Band Shoshone cousin of mine, who does not represent the Eastern Band Shoshone Nation in any way, shape, or form. That the Comanches lost this game and they left. And so, but they had horses at that point. So, and I think it was like the Ute. No, it was Shoshone. Shoshone's got horses early, and them and the Crow do not get along. And one of the first times the Crow saw horses where they were when the Shoshones were on horseback and absolutely just ran the Crow over and completely changing Plains warfare. But we're totally digressing. It would have been cool to see more horse combat. Like, we get a little bit of it, which was really cool to see. And more importantly, in that scene where the brother is taking on the predator on horseback, it's also showing how the Comanche kit was more better suited to fending off the predator than the Euro-American kit, right? Like, the guns aren't working. They're not working at all throughout this. The only time there seems to be effective is when she headshots the predator from the back and blows off its mask, and she's able to like run and get it. That seems to be the only time where those firearms were effective. Even then, though, the way they show the damage of some of those muskets, because we're not talking about rifles yet, of the French, I mean, those muskets were firing like 55 caliber smoothbore projectiles. Like, they would have done way more damage, and it kind of shows it seems like they were doing like 22 or BB gun damage, but it's like, no, those things were like blowing people's arms off in the Revolutionary War. Like, those things had some kick to them. So I think they might have like toned down the difficulty level on those French firearms, but overall, that scene in which the brothers just on horseback showing how the rapid fire prowess of those Comanche bows that were built, like, bows on the plains used to be much longer, like long bows, because you had to traverse these distances and pierce rawhide shields. When you get the horse right, it becomes one weapon system. And so the bows get shorter, like short bows. And so you're able to maneuver far better around the horse and be able to fire accurately, because you're not firing those long distances anymore. You're getting up much more close and personal. So you need something that's real whippy. You know, it's real quick at first. It might not have the range, but it has the velocity near term to do the damage you need to take out a bison or injure someone you're not having good relations with.
And I guess also that the kind of draw time for the shorter bow is less as well. So you can rapid fire essentially with the shorter bow, which you can't with the longer.
Yeah. And they show like when they're going after that cat, they have the one knocked in and then they have one or two that they're grasping at the edge, right? So they can immediately get at least two or three off before having to go into their quivers, which I don't think any of them were ever shown as being kind of that English style from the back pulling over the shoulder and in. All the quivers I have seen are those like plains side quivers that kind of rest on your back and then you pull them from the side, and kind of that same different mechanic.
I read that the earlier version of the script didn't have any horses, and their Comanche consultant was like, you can't have Comanche without horses, and that's why they added that horse scene. But yeah, it would have been cool to see a lot more horses in the movie.
100%. And the show, like, in the arrows, I believe everyone who had arrows in the movie, they had different painted arrows, right? Like, each of those arrows were specific to the hunter, so that way when that's how you track who killed something or how to claim credit, is like you look at the arrow markings to figure out who it belongs to. So I thought that was rather neat that it wasn't just these plain unadored arrows, but everyone kind of had their own little flair, had decorated theirs to mark whose it belonged to.
one of the things in this movie that we, another one of these sort of Comanche things is when Naru is describing the predator that she saw that nobody else has seen yet. She calls it a Muppets, and everyone responds that that's just from a children's story. And, you know, one of the things in researching this movie is all of these Comanche words that I'm searching for, everything that comes up is conversations about this movie. So there are several sources talking about a Muppetsi or a Muppets or a Pia Muppets. And apparently this is a story about a giant owl that would eat people. And it was a cannibal owl, which I don't know why it's a cannibal if it's an owl that eats humans. But apparently this was a story that parents would tell their children to keep their children from going into dangerous places or going out at night or something like that.
Yeah, owls, especially in Plains Indian culture, are absolute devil birds that should be eradicated from this planet in any way, shape, or form. They're animals that are greatly distressing to many nations because they represent death and ill luck. I mean, right, and if you look at from broadly, like, why do Plains Indians think this and other Indian nations, like, they don't fit taxonomically with what other birds do. Like, they're quiet, they move at night, even when they fly, they're quiet. And then their heads can rotate like the girl from The Exorcist. So, like, it makes sense conceptually why tribes are like, yeah, this bird is different, this bird is evil, and it represents badness. So, like, it, when, yeah, when looking at that Muppetsi or whatever they talk about it, yeah, it's like, oh, that's a, it's a, it's a horrible, disgusting owl that eats children. I was like, yeah, that makes sense. I can get behind that. but part of that mythos, though, is there's that scene towards the end where our heroine is, Naru, is using the French trader as bait, where she's talking to him. There's a scene where, like, they can hear it coming, and she whistles. And for me, so I was watching this. So, like, my partner is Cherokee, and her background is in film and media. So she helped me prepare for today because I was not catching half the stuff that she was talking about. But when that, you're never supposed to whistle at night because that calls in monsters in our culture. And so at night, there's this scene where it's not blatantly said, unless you're indigenous and know what that meant, when she does that quick whistle to call in the monster at night, I lost it. I was like, oh shit, that's right. So
cool.
That was a cool little, yeah, like, cultural moment that was inserted into the film. And sorry, my cat is about to walk through the front of the screen here in a second. As you were saying, Josh,
I think it must have been in elementary school. We must have had like a unit on Inuit culture or something, because I remember learning that the Inuit in northern Canada have a similar thing where whistling would bring the northern lights, and the northern lights are the spirits of dead people who are playing a football game in the sky. And so if you whistle, the northern lights, it'll bring the northern lights closer, but you don't want them to get too close, because if they get too close, they will cut off your head and use it as their football. So you can draw the northern lights in by whistling, or you can chase them away by clapping. And I don't know how true this is. I'm not sure how good, how sensitive our cultural education was in elementary school in rural Canada in the 90s. But I do remember as a child being outside on the playground at night and whistling when the northern lights were out to try and draw them in, and then getting scared and running away.
Yes. And part of that, though, is that story is like, so to tell children to put their hoods on their parkas, right, to keep them cold. So there's kind of like a functionalist aspect to that story. It's like, you know, if you don't keep your head up, and when the kids are playing, they'll come and use your head for that ball game. It's also like, it's nighttime in the Arctic and it's cold. If you don't have your hood on, you will die. So it is kind of, there's might be a purpose behind it. And they show that story really well in the game Never Alone. It came out, I think, in 2014. It is a video game that's completely developed by Inuit folks, and
this is on my Steam wish list. I'm waiting for it to go on sale again.
So fun. And one of those levels is trying to actually navigate the Arctic at night and trying to dodge the northern lights as they come to try to take your head. And what's cool about that game also is that you find the little Easter eggs that you find are actually interviews with knowledge keepers about the purpose of the game and what you're seeing and what it means. And so it's a very holistic cultural experience that I'm entirely envious of. So that was
cool.
Here's a story. My partner, Aurora, her friend, has a job at a company in Winnipeg here where they basically send all the stuff up north for the stores. There's like, it's called like the Northern Store. It's like the store in these small communities. And so they basically supply everything. It's like a general store. They, of course, have to send parkas up there. And Canada Goose is one of these big, fancy, expensive parkas that traditionally have had, in the modern style, have had fur around the collars. But apparently the style is changing. And so they've made them without the fur around the collars now, because in the South here, it's fashion. But in the North, that's a required part of the collar. So basically, she said that because they have these parkas that don't have the fur, they have like paired up with the women in the community. So they send the parkas up there, and then they've got the women to sew the fur back onto these $1,000 parkas so that they can sell them in the store and they'll be actually functional in the North.
That's pretty neat. What else do we have from this movie? I'm trying to think what else happens. That's pretty...
Well, we can talk about the Predator itself. The Predator got a redesign here. It's called a feral Predator. It is in some ways more primitive. I think what they're going for here is we're looking at less advanced human technology, and we're pairing that with a less advanced Predator technology. So there's sort of a parallel. But it kind of doesn't make any sense. And there's a description from the filmmaker here about this idea that they've sort of toned down the Predator's technology. And in particular, he doesn't have that iconic Predator helmet. He's wearing a skull of an animal, which I think is a canonical animal from a different movie or something like that, from a different Predator movie. But he said, "We've seen the helmet, but once again, maybe this guy 300 years ago didn't have access to the same technology." And this is a nonsense thing to say, because he shows up in a spaceship, an intergalactic spaceship with invisibility technology. He's got invisibility. He's got laser-guided seeking missiles from his helmet. He's got a laser on his helmet. He's got heat vision built into his helmet. But he didn't have the technology for a metal helmet, so he had to put this on a skull that he found. That's kind of the silliest thing I've ever heard.
And, yeah. And mind you, right, like, in Alien versus Predator, they already established the energy weapons, building the pyramids, and that was supposed to happen, like, the 1600s or whatever. They have this ancient astronaut theory BS. But in that, I don't know if that's technically canon anymore. Like, they had energy weapons, they had the face mask. And even still in this movie where they're, you know, I was reading that too of like, okay, why the major redesign? Biologically, you don't go from having those top mandibles all the way at the side of your eyes to down low in 300 years. That's bonkers. Mm-hmm. That's not how that works. And then with the technology, as you said, when they show the ship flying in, it is the same ship they used in every form of Predator media. Like, that hasn't gone through a redesign. But I think ultimately, right, they just wanted, everyone knows what the Predator looks like. The old Predator is your dad's Predator that used to haunt his dreams. They needed something a little bit newer to get people to be afraid of the Predator again. It's like, well, why don't we make something that's a little bit more feral? You know, even still with the bone mask, the laser is built into the mask itself. But yeah, then they're like, we can't have energy weapons, you know? So then they use the missile thing.
I mean, it would have made more sense if they did something like your parka's story, Josh, if it was just a fashion choice, like, you know, the Predators are as fashionable as the next group. And so this year skulls were in and metal was out. That would be a reasonable explanation.
He's a feral Predator. He's not... he's a back to the land kind of, trendy kind of guy. He's not following the modern technology. He's doing it old school. He's bow hunting instead of hunting with a modern rifle.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But even still, that like fire and forget dart is still terrifying. Yeah. It doesn't blow up and melt people at the end, but like that thing seems a little bit more. At times
still goes right through you
and you can direct it, and it's like, wait a minute, that's still pretty nuts.
I've got another quote here about the Predator redesign. I'm not sure who this quote is from, but I think I took this from IMDb trivia. whoever this is says, Comanches had their sophisticated tactics, but we're dealing with bows and spears and stuff. So you want to make sure that the feral predator's weaponry matches a little more equally to that. At first, the ADI team explored an extremely primitive look for the feral predator. We actually played around with the idea of a caveman predator and a Neanderthal predator. And Ross, we just watched this movie.
Yeah.
We just reviewed for Halloween a movie called The Lost Tribe, which was about a lost tribe of prehistoric humans,
yeah.
But it stole a ton vision. From Predator with Predator vision, and she had to cover herself in this berry goo so the Predator tribe couldn't see her. So it's funny that they're talking about a Neanderthal Predator, and this movie from 15 years ago that we watched a couple of weeks ago was also playing with that this idea of a caveman or Neanderthal Predator. So I don't know. Interesting how this alien keeps coming back to our caveman podcast here.
Yeah. They need to get some new ideas. I think maybe it's the upshot of that.
Yeah, I thought the redesign was pretty slick. I mean, it
looks cool.
It does look cool. And they show it kind of quickly how the mask works. But there's that moment, though, where he's kind of tracking. Like, he doesn't have his mask on, but towards the end, tracking the trap of the blood. I'm not sure how he's able to do that without the mask, though, because like I am fairly confident from either Predator 1 or Predator 2, without the mask, their vision is really bad. And I think it's like in a red scale, but I have to double check. So I think other than that, let's just
wait. So their mask is essentially like varifocals as well as heat vision.
Yeah. Precisely. Yeah. Let me double check.
You know, we watch a lot of really bad movies, and this is quite a good movie. It's, you know, it's well written too. And there's a lot of things we could talk about in that. Like the, I'm realizing, I don't think I've ever seen the original Predator movie, which I'm going to have to definitely do. But yeah. in the original Predator, Arnie has to, you know, his modern technology isn't working. So I think he ends up killing the Predator with, you know, a bow and arrow or some
sticks.
So he sort of, yeah. So he's fighting the new high tech guy with the older primitive technology. And this, we've got some sort of opposites, right? So in this movie, first of all, one of the cool things, which I might not have noticed if I hadn't read it on IMDb, is that the Predator always attacks in parallel to the way its prey is attacking it, right? So right from the first scene, the snake, he sort of spears it through the head with two sort of kind of fangs, right?
Yeah, those claws that are his gauntlet claws, those things. Yeah.
He sort of bear wrestles the bear, right? When we have him fighting the French, he responds in kind with the same weapon. You know, the French capture him in a net. He captures the guy in a net. He's always responding in parallel with what's attacking him. But also we have the contrast in the way he gets killed in the end, because this Predator, it seems like, is sort of I don't know if it's canonical, but I read somewhere that this is supposed to be like its first hunt. Like, this is a new Predator. He's inexperienced, and he starts off small and builds his way up and gets more and more confident. And as he gets overconfident, he gets sloppier. And so he takes a lot of damage in this movie. And the deeper we get into the movie, the sloppier he gets and the more damage he takes. And this contrasts with Naru's journey, where she starts off sloppy and she gets more and more refined. And also, in contrast to the original movie, she kills the Predator with high technology that she's just learning how to use. Mm-hmm. And so instead of this return to simpler technology, the Predator itself has to revert to simpler and simpler ways. And she is reverting, she's gaining more and more advanced ways. And of course, she gets the Predator with his own Predator seeking helmet and with her French gun, right?
Right.
And yeah. So like very, very competently written movie.
Yeah. But that's also built into the lore of the Predator series, right? Like, these things are not, it's not just the trophy aspect of like the Predator society, but it's also that, like when I mentioned at the top of the episode, right? It's also the Predator's coming of age ceremony. Like, they're being dropped in to hunt these animals as a show of character and strength, which corresponds to what you're saying of like, depending on its prey is the method that it's using to take it out. And so even for, this predator, this feral predator in particular, right? It just makes, it fits within the lore as to what's happening. It's unsportsmanlike to go in with like a nuke or even, you know, like you never see them use their ships, except I think for Alien versus Predator, the video game from I think like 2013 or something like that, is the only time you ever see like ship combat. But outside of that, they're just dropped in, usually one, if not teams of three, to do what they need to do in order to gain status within their own predator society.
I think that's part of what makes it such a compelling baddie, is that it's not just, you know, a kind of implacable monster with unknown reasoning. We can kind of understand, oh, it's a sportsman. It wants to, it has its own rules, and you know, those rules are easy to kind of grasp, and we can see him operating under that kind of honor system, which makes him a much more compelling character than just a kind of monster of the week kind of baddie.
Precisely.
And that also plays into our plot here, because our main character keeps getting away from the predator because he doesn't see her as a threat in the same way that the men in her society also don't think she's capable of doing this. And so she's able to use that to her advantage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the first time she gets away, right, it would be unsporting because she gets caught in a trap. And then the predator's like, well, the hunt's on, because he was going for her. Like, it's not like she was messing around with him and he was ignoring her, like... He was gunning for her until she got trapped. And then the second time, she's able to escape. But I think up until that point, you know, that idea of when she says, you know, didn't see me as a threat, it's like, well, it did, but, you know, it would have been unsporting to kill you then. And more importantly, it introduced the predator to the French more holistically. Because they ask about it. The French guys are talking about, like, what is this creature? Have you seen it? Although it might have happened off screen where he'd been terrorizing them before. But earlier in the film, when he comes across one of the traps, he's looking at it pretty intimately, like, okay, what is this? Because it's something different than what he'd been seeing with the bear, the wolf, the rattlesnake. So, gosh, only knows what he was doing. I guess that could have been the red lights at the cougar hunt, like going way back to the movie, earlier part of the movie, where she's in the tree, gonna kill the cougar to get that rank. But then she's distracted by like red lights off into the distance. And that's when the cougar pounces. She stabs it, but she knocks herself out. So I guess maybe at that point is when the predator had run into the French the first time, if that's any sort of explanation.
I think I'm to the end of my notes. Do we have anything else to say about this?
Not really. I think overall, well done, other than some like timing of where the Comanche and the Northern Great Plains. I thought at this point they should be in the Southern Plains, but you know, I thought that duality of showing like very quickly the European trap and then the alien sounds of the ship coming in, like the two different aliens that are encroaching. Overall, I thought it was really well done. The only other thing's showing the bison slaughter. This had been like way too early. Right? Like, I don't think the French were in there in that mass up in the upper Missouri quite yet. But like the meadow bison out in Appalachia in the eastern part of the states in Canada, I know those populations were collapsing by then, but the strategic going far out west, knocking out bison herds wasn't really a thing until the 1800s after the eastern woodlands bison had been annihilated.
Yeah, the fur traders were trapping mostly, right? They weren't, buffalo hides were never the big money item. It was beaver pelts mainly. Yeah, So, it's weird that these French were taking these bison pelts.
Yeah.
One thing I want to mention, because I'm from Winnipeg. Winnipeggers have this thing because we're this like small, big city. And whenever Winnipeg gets mentioned anywhere, we have to like point it out to sort of like prove our value as a city. Where I know Amber Midthunder, the actor who plays Naru in this movie, where I knew her from before this was a movie called The Ice Road, where she played alongside Liam Neeson. Have you either of you seen this movie?
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
And it's not a great movie, but I had to watch it because it's set in Winnipeg and Manitoba, and it's based on these TV shows on like Discovery Channel called like Ice Road Truckers. But this is a real thing in Manitoba where we have these remote northern communities where we don't have good roads to get up there, but what we do have are huge lakes. And so in the winter, when the roads become impassable, they plow highways along these lakes, and these huge trucks go up north to these communities, taking supplies because there's no other ways to get supplies there. And actually, the ice roads are more reliable than the summer roads because the ice roads are only open for a certain period of time. So all these companies send these trucks up across the lakes to get to these communities. And then in the spring and summer, you can't get trucks up there because the roads are no good. But with climate change, the window for the ice roads is closing. So we have less and less time every year to get these trucks up there. Anyway, she stars in that movie alongside Liam Neeson, and she's great in that movie, even though it's not a great movie, but I liked it a lot because it's set in Winnipeg, or they start in Winnipeg and travel up the lakes.
All right.
Cool. So, Carlton, you are also a host of a podcast on the Archaeology Podcast Network.
I am, the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast, where we talk about all things Great Plains Archaeology. Yes, it comes out every other week, little 30-minute episodes. They're a fun time.
Cool. I've been listening to it. You close every episode with a quote from an American author I don't know. What is that quote that you close your show with?
Oh, well, Catherine, anyone can love the mountains, but only a true soul can love the prairie. I think that's that one. I've recorded that with like episode zero, so it is just the drag and drop tagline that Chris and Rachel use. But I think that's the quote that's in the back. I usually don't get that far into my episodes.
I love that quote so much because I'm a prairie boy and I've seen mountains, and like, yes, mountains, they're obviously powerful when you see them, but the longer I'm away from the prairie, the more uncomfortable I get.
Oh, absolutely. And
listen to yourselves.
My favorite place to be is on the prairie. There's something about a prairie landscape that no other landscape, feels like to me, and nobody else appreciates it because they're like, it's just flat, there's nothing here. But like, you're not seeing it, you're not seeing the biodiversity, you're not seeing the plants, you're not seeing what's going on here. So I love that quote so much.
Two flatlanders up against a Highlander, I mean, that doesn't sound fair to me.
I don't mind mountains, it's trees I can't stand. The eastern woodlands, I get claustrophobic when I'm in dense forest like that. I'm like, I don't see the sky, I'm unnerved.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, that was a fun when you guys ever get around to, you know, either Revenant or Dance with Wolves, you let me know. Happy to chat about those.
Sure. Totally. Sounds great. We branch out of caveman movies once in a while, so if we want to do something where we can talk more about some North American archaeology, we're definitely going to have you back.
Absolutely appreciate it. You guys have done Clan of the Cave Bear, right?
Yes, did Clan of the Cave Bear pretty early on.
Yeah, okay, that's what I figured. When I was first introduced to you as a show, I was like, I bet they've done Clan of the Cave Bear. And sure enough, it was like one of the top first 10. I was like, that makes sense.
Do you have questions, comments, or movie requests? We want to hear from you. Find us on Blue Sky and Facebook at SOTSA Podcast. Send us an email to screensofthestoneage@gmail.com or visit our website at screensofthestoneage.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.